Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Unheard News. I'm Freddie Sayers. Ever since the fighting started in Ukraine, we've been trying to talk to an official representative of the Russian government, of the government of Vladimir Putin, to understand, at the very least, how they are framing their arguments. Well, it's been a long time coming, but today we are joined by Dmitry Polyansky, who is the first deputy permanent representative from Russia to the United Nations. So he represents the Putin regime to the UN. He joins us from New York. Thank you for talking to Unheard, Mr. Polyansky.
Thank you, Freddie. I would just like to correct that I'm representing Russia and not Putin regime to the UN.
Let's try and start with the basics here. We're talking across such a wide, I suppose you'd call it, informational divide when the very definitions are under dispute. Beginning with the basics, is it right what I hear that according to the Russian government, there is no war in Ukraine? That word isn't used. And actually, there has been no invasion by Russia. Is that what the Russian government still maintains?
Exactly. Well, my English is not brilliant, of course, but I think that there is a big difference between a war and a special military operation. A war means that we declare this country that is being invaded an enemy state, that there is a total war altogether, there is a mobilization, there are overall targets, so it's kind of people-to-people war, let's put it this way.
So what is the... what the benefit of that distinction is when we see on TV cameras so much...
If you don't interrupt me, I will explain to you what's the difference. As for the special military operation, the special military operation means it's a targeted military operation. And we, from the very beginning, from the outset, said that our task was to stop the ongoing war in Donbas, which Ukraine has been waging for 8 years already. So our task was to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine, first and foremost, because these two factors represented a threat to the republics of Donbas, which we recognized. And also it represented an existential threat to Russia. And with the pace of the military operation, we get more and more proofs that we're absolutely right in estimating the threat like this. So I don't know if it's clear to you the difference that we imply in these two things.
So you said there that it's specifically focused on the Donbass. Is that still the case? Obviously, there's been military activity almost throughout the country of Ukraine. Why has that happened?
The main target was the bringing peace to Donbas, but because of the fact that there was and there still is a very significant Ukrainian military group situated across near the line of contact with Donbas republics, it was absolutely necessary to limit and to deprive them of military supplies. Kind of deprive them of the possibility to shell the civilian areas of Donetsk and Lugansk, and in order to fulfill this task, it was not possible to limit the military special military operation to kind of specific areas. That's why we had to target military infrastructure, which we are doing still right now. But in the first days of this special military operation, we were especially active in hitting In heating airfields, the places where there where the fuel is collected, the bases, and all these things. So we had really to kind of weaken this military detachment in Donbas to the extent that they would stop their shellings and they would stop their war against the civilian population in Donbas. So target is Donbas always, but without demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine, it's not possible to bring peace to this region. It's not possible to counter the threat which Ukraine represents to the Russian Federation.
Okay, so I'd like to dig into both of those if we could. So we leave the Nazi thing for later, but the okay. Demilitarization, is it your view, or is it the view of the Russian government that Donbas is part of Russia? Is that your
No.
the official position?
No, absolutely.
In which case, why would
recognized,
you... Why is it the responsibility of Russia to have a special military operation inside the Donbas?
Well, we started this special military operation after we recognized the independence of these two republics, which was declared 8 years ago. By the way, today the Donetsk People's Republic celebrates exactly 8 years since the proclamation of independence. At that point of time, we didn't recognize the independence of these two republics. But when the threat from Ukraine became clearer and clearer, and when the numbers of Ukrainian soldiers stationed at the line of contacts became absolutely obvious that it represented a threat to these republics, when Ukraine, its political leadership, its diplomatic leadership, blatantly rejected the Minsk agreements, which represented the only international plan for the resolution of crisis in Donbas, the east of Ukraine, then we understood that there is absolutely no other option. And by the way, when the West rejected any discussion with us on security guarantees, which it was also part of a bigger picture of the whole situation, then we understood that there is absolutely no other way but to hit the Ukrainian military infrastructure. And on the eve of this, if you roll a little bit back in history, you will find the news that exactly on the eve of this, of the beginning of the special military operation, the shellings of civilian infrastructure in Donetsk and Lugansk intensified, and there was a really a big numbers of refugees coming to Russian Federation, hundreds of thousands in the weekend.
You've used in what you just said the phrase "bringing peace to the Donbas."
Yeah.
I mean, you're an intelligent, highly educated man.
Thank you.
You can't seriously believe that the net effect of the past 2 months has been to bring peace to the Donbas.
Sometimes there is no other solution. Of course, nobody likes to wage military activities, and we would prefer another option, a diplomatic option. But there was absolutely no way to stop the war. Did you, a very intelligent and well-educated person, did you know a lot about a war in Donbas for these 8 years? I think it was not the picture on Western media, and there was absolutely different picture. We knew it from refugees that came to Moscow. There were, by this moment, about 3 million of refugees from Donbas. I personally had in my country house a family from Donbas, which escaped from the shellings of Ukrainian army. So we knew it from our own experience.
Just to be specific, then, was it a kind? Is it? Are you framing it as a humanitarian intervention in some way to defend the people of Donbas, or are you framing it as defending the Russian Federation from some sort of military threat? Which is the rationale?
I think you can frame it in between. Because first and foremost, of course, this was the first objective that you mentioned, to save the civilian population of Donbas. But in the meantime, during the course of our military operation, we discovered things that leave absolutely no doubt that Ukraine was long ago premeditated as part of a proxy war of Western countries against Russia. I think today or yesterday, the official spokesman of Pentagon, I think Mr. Kirby, if I'm not mistaken, he confirmed that the West was preparing Ukraine, these are his words, was preparing Ukraine for this war for 8 years. So he was kind of boasting the fact that Ukraine is capable of waging the war in Russia, but
he spilled this information. So yeah. Specifically, you're asking us to believe that Russia thinks that Ukraine was about to invade Russia.
I wouldn't say that Ukraine was about to invade Russia, but Ukraine was about to invade Donetsk and Lugansk People Republics. And we discovered these military documents, the originals of these documents, in the bunkers, in the liberated territories. So it was, I think, it was absolutely equal, because we made it from the clear from the very outset that this is a red line for us. The start of an offensive in Donbas would be casus belli for Russia.
So if we talk about Kiev and some of the action around the country, was the shelling of Kiev and the encirclement or almost encirclement of the capital, and then the apparent retreat from the capital, is your explanation again that it wasn't a retreat and it was all part of a master plan to distract in one side of the country, and it was always planned to retreat? Or what's the official line on that?
Was there encirclement of Kiev? I'm not aware of this. I know that there were Russian troops around, because they had to be there to distract the military detachments of Ukrainian army to fight them and to annihilate them. I forgot the English word for that.
To distract
and to neutralize. Yeah, okay. Let's use this word. To neutralize several detachments or powerful detachments of Ukrainian army. There were also the target was also to neutralize military infrastructure, to eliminate a lot of military objects, which we did. There was never a task of attacking Kiev and encircling Kiev, because, as you know, there were a lot of visitors coming to Kiev, even at the time when there were Russian detachments around. And again, you mentioned shelling Kiev. I would say that we shelled only with high-precision weapons. We shelled the infrastructure objects. Damage that was caused to civilian infrastructure to a large extent was caused by Ukrainian anti-missile defense, and they acknowledged that at some point.
So you're saying there was no change of strategy, the objectives that you planned in Kiev have been met, and that's why you've retreated?
First of all, you shouldn't forget that I'm a diplomat, I'm not a military person. So if my leadership has certain military plan, I think I would be the last person with whom they would share it. And it's absolutely right, because I'm not part of the military planning. But I wonder why people had in mind that we from the very beginning had the objective of capturing Kiev. I don't think it was the case. The case was to inflict the biggest possible damage and neutralize military infrastructure and military capacities of the Ukrainian army. And I think that this objective was absolutely achieved during the initial part of the operation.
What about the losses on the Russian side? Estimates range from 15,000 to 25,000 Russian troops that have sadly lost their lives. What is your statement on that?
I haven't heard the exact figures for a long time. The last figure I heard from the Ministry of Defense was something less than 2,000. I'm not sure it's the actual figure, but I don't have new ones. I know that the press secretary of our president said the losses were high, but I know that during this military operation, it's normal not to disclose certain information that can be sensitive. So we'll count.
We're just
losses
dealing with such divergence, aren't we, of the basic facts of on the ground, that 2,000 to 25,000, there's almost no point of reference. Let me ask you about something which you...
But if I may return
a
little bit to the number of losses. We have the Ukrainian representative here, and I think that the tactics of calculation of alleged Russian losses is very simple. They simply take the statistics provided by Russian Ministry of Defense about the Ukrainian losses, and which seems to be more or less accurate to us, and then they add 2,000 to 3,000 people to it, and it's normal picture.
Okay.
So I don't think it's trustworthy.
So, moving as it were south around the country, members of your administration have talked about an objective of the Russian Federation to establish a land bridge from the main part of Russia all the way along the coast all the way to Transnistria. Is that true? Is that the objective? And is that one of the definitions of success of this operation?
To be frank, I haven't heard official declarations stating this objective. I heard some people saying that this might be the objective. It wouldn't be wise for us to withdraw from other areas which are already under our control, because otherwise there would be other bloody provocations by Ukraine and the West. That's what I heard. But again, it's not an official estimate, and I haven't heard any official declarations that our task of our military operation is anything other than the safety of Donbas, because what we need there is to annihilate this detachment, the very, very, very reinforced Ukrainian positions, which were created for 8 years and which number from 60 to 70,000 soldiers, and which continue to shell the Donetsk and Lugansk regions on a daily basis. And now they do it with the artillery, so it means that even if we push them further, they can still find the means to cover this range and to kill people there. Today, several people were killed in Donetsk from shellings.
Let me ask you a question which I think you should be able to answer. You're a senior diplomat from Russia. Is there a diplomatic solution to this? Is there a deal that Russia would accept and that you would overnight withdraw from Ukraine? Is there such a deal?
Well, I'm a high-ranking diplomat, but I'm not high-ranking, of course, enough to decide such issues. I have an impression that the negotiations that were held in Istanbul on the eve of our withdrawal, again, voluntary withdrawal from certain regions of Kiev region and Chernigov region. So at these negotiations, I think at some point of time, we were close to certain understanding, to certain realistic understanding of Ukraine, of what the situation is. That's what I heard from my colleagues who were participating in the negotiations.
What was that specifically, just so we know
what you mean? That was very roughly, that was security guarantees to Ukraine, to neutral Ukraine, not a member of NATO, not a member of alliances, which didn't cover Donetsk, Lugansk regions and Crimea. So it meant that Ukraine was kind of accepting the status quo, which was before the start of the special military operation. But then the Ukrainian...
So just to be clear, that would be a guarantee not to join NATO and the European Union, or are you less bothered about the European Union?
I think we were at this point not very worrying about European Union, but the situation has changed after Mr. Borrell's statement that this war should be won on the battleground, and after the fact that the European Union is the leader of deliveries of arms. I think that our position on European Union now is more similar to NATO, because we don't see big difference.
So you need you're looking for a guarantee of no membership of NATO or the European Union. And as for the Donbas regions, in this deal, they would be specially administered UN zones, or would they be Russia?
They declared independence, so it's up to them to decide. But I didn't say that this is the end formula of the deal. So these were the basic parameters, because since from the outset we also spoke about demilitarization and denazification, which is very important. And I don't think that these two objectives would be put aside at the end of the road. But it was a good start, and that's why we decided to make this gesture to withdraw the troops from certain regions of Kiev and Chernigov Oblast and regions. And what did we get in exchange? At this point, I don't see, frankly, no diplomatic possibilities, given the position of Ukraine, given the kind of fueling this conflict by the West. Being a diplomat, I need to acknowledge that there is no way for diplomacy now.
So I guess the next question must be, if there isn't a diplomatic end, what is going to happen? What is your forecast of how this plays out now?
Well, first of all, we think about provision of security, provision of peaceful life, returning of peaceful life to Donbas. This is long overdue. So we need to secure these areas from Ukrainian shelling. So we need to give these people the right to live peacefully, as every other peaceful people.
It's a war zone at the moment, full of Russian troops. It couldn't be further from a peaceful life that you're giving them.
This zone is not full of Russian troops. This zone is full of troops of these republics, which was always the case. And the OSCE mission was not able to find any Russian troops there despite all the efforts. So don't make a mistake. They are fighting for their land, and they will continue to do it.
Is your position there are no Russian troops in the Donbass region? I mean, that's I haven't heard that one before.
As far as I am informed, the military detachments of Donbass and Lugansk republics are pushing from their side, and the Russian units are pushing from Kharkov region and from the south. So not from
Believe that we are set for a long and protracted military confrontation, according to what you've said about there not being a diplomatic solution?
I don't know. Frankly, I don't have a crystal ball to predict such things. But it depends on, if the conflict in Ukraine is tried to be stopped by pouring the gas into the fire by the Western countries, of course, and it can be protracted for some time, but it wouldn't change the whole pace of the conflict. It wouldn't prevent Russia to reach the objectives that we put forward. And the moment Ukraine acknowledges the fact that it has to make concessions, it has to denazify, it has to demilitarize, it has to acknowledge the fact that the people in the east of Ukraine also have the right to live the lives that they want, then the war would stop. The military operation would stop, yeah.
Let's zoom out, if we can, please, and look at the effect on the wider region, because if the objective was to increase the security of Russia, it feels like the net effect of this whole last few months has been to strengthen the alliance against Russia. And now the latest news is that Sweden and Finland are also thinking of joining NATO. And actually today, a bilateral security guarantee was signed between the UK and Sweden. What is your comment on that? And how will Russia react to the Sweden and Finland joining NATO?
It's up to...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finns and Swedes to decide the way they secure their military capacities, whatever. They know that the moment they become members of the NATO, it will imply certain mirror moves on the Russian side, which... usually affects NATO member states. So
what
somehow
does that mean?
For It means that if there are NATO detachments in this territory, so this territory would become a target, a possible target for a strike, in the same way that Russian territory becomes possible target of a strike the moment the NATO detachments are introduced in the neighboring areas.
So this you would move detachments to lap the borders or places the sea outside
again,
Sweden? What does that mean?
I'm not a military man, but I know that NATO is a very unfriendly bloc to us. This is an enemy, and NATO itself admitted that Russia is an enemy. It means that Finland and Sweden, all of a sudden, instead of neutral countries, become part of the enemy, and they bear all the risks as everybody. So they would bear certain defense risks, of course. They would bear certain economic costs. But it's up to them to decide. It's up to their population to decide. They were living normally as good neighbors with us for tens of years. If they suddenly choose to become part of the very unfriendly bloc, it's up to them. But of course, we will have certain moves. We'll have to take the certain military
clearly
moves.
They are making that decision in response to what they perceive as Russian aggression in Ukraine, and that's why this has happened. It's not a coincidence that they want to join NATO 2 months after the invasion of Ukraine. So in effect, that's a result of Russian actions, isn't it?
I think we can look from different angle, because they are doing it because of the many years campaign by NATO countries against Russia, the very unfriendly campaign. The proxy war that NATO is conducting in Ukraine. So I think that this was not the the prize or the target of NATO today to get these two countries into NATO, but this was a long-term invitation that was standing there. And I remember even before that, there were a lot of invitations for these two countries to join NATO for different reasons. But I don't think it will be really a blow to the security of Russia, because these two states would become members of NATO. Hopefully they won't, but if they do it would be the worst solution for them, but not for Russia. Russia is ready to face NATO threat. Russia has made necessary precautions for this. It doesn't change very much the security situation in Europe, which is dominated and aggravated by NATO threat to Russia for many, many years. So
let me ask about that big picture security threat. Something obviously that everyone is very frightened of and worried about is the possibility of a nuclear escalation. Under what circumstances would Russia feel justified in launching a nuclear attack anywhere?
Again, I'm not a military man. It's not up to me to make such a conclusion. But I think that if you deal with a nuclear state, if you threaten a military state, you should count on all the options there on the table.
Do you believe that any of the criteria, because I heard some talk from Russian sources that some of the criteria that is internally used to justify a nuclear strike have already been reached by your own definitions? It's an attack on Russian soil, if you call some of these areas Russian soil. Do you sign up to that from a sort of diplomatic point of view?
I haven't heard such assessment, frankly. I'm a diplomat and I'm not dealing with the decision-making circles on the implementation of nuclear strategy. But I can tell you that, yes, we possess nuclear weapons. Yes, if there is an existential threat to Russia, then I'm absolutely sure that we can use nuclear weapons.
Is that the definition, that it needs to be an existential threat to Russia?
Yeah, but I'm not the one who would define what is an existential threat. So
who is? But who makes that definition?
People who get salary for resolution of military issues. I'm getting my payroll for diplomatic issues, so I'm not the right person to be asked about it. But
so I understand, if the president, Putin, decides that an existential threat is now underway, I mean, he's used language which is not very far from that, would he, according to your own internal rubric, be justified in launching a nuclear strike?
Well, he's a commander-in-chief. Of course, he has all the possibilities to decide so with the commanders of Ministry of Defense. Again, if you are threatening a nuclear power, I think you should calculate all the risks. That's very easy.
Do you know anything about the sequence of command or what the internal protocol is for this for such a strike? Because it's something that obviously people are very anxious about. Is it simply that if Mr. Putin decides, wakes up one day and decides to launch a nuclear strike, he can? Or does he require the agreement of a certain number of senior officials? Or what actually would happen?
I'm absolutely not aware of the protocol. Again, this is much beyond my payroll. But I can tell you that if Britain is threatening Russia every day, if Britain is supplying arms, if British military leadership is saying that it is legitimate for Ukraine to use British weapons to strike infrastructure on Russian territory itself, and there were such statements, I can imagine that British citizens and British taxpayers can be worried about the possibility of the aggravation of this war, because this is absolutely reckless what Britain is doing. But I'm far from.
Are you worried
far
about it? Do you think the nuclear possibility is a serious possibility, and is that something you worry about?
I'm not a British taxpayer, so that's why I shouldn't be worried. I'm not threatening Russia. Britain is threatening Russia, not vice versa.
I'm asking how likely you think a nuclear outcome is. Is it an edge case possibility that we shouldn't spend too much time on?
Let's not go to hypothetical scenarios. We have what we have. So far, NATO directly is not involved, and I think that was formulated by the president as a criteria that anybody who would try to interfere would get an adequate response. So far, NATO is waging very active but still proxy war, and I think we have military means to cope this threat quite effectively. But I don't know what will go afterwards. What I can tell you for sure is that the political relations between Russia and the UK are spoiled for ages to come because of such reckless behavior of the British government. That's for sure. It has nothing to do with nuclear war, but it has a lot to do with the normal norms of human behavior.
Let me ask you to conclude, if I could. Zooming out, your supposed objective was greater peace and security. It looks to any outsider like the net effect for Russia is economic isolation, a very much strengthened league and alliance against you, with increased military activity on your border. In what sense, huge losses of young men's lives and others, in what sense can this be deemed to have been a successful operation?
I think everything that you said is wishful thinking. Because if you speak about economic isolation, I don't think Russia is isolated. First of all, we were isolated for quite a lot of time. And the sanctions is not something that happened yesterday. They happened quite some time ago. We were ready for these sanctions. Our economy feels quite okay. We have alternative markets for our products. We have managed to make a lot of things ourselves, which we were not able to do several years ago. The Russian ruble is very stable right now, despite all the predictions. The population is quite calm. The unemployment rates are okay. So I don't know what do you mean by economic problems for Russia. As for consolidation of the West, wasn't it consolidated before? I think that if you speak about the West, it's only United States and the countries that would come to its heel when Washington whistles. So like UK, like the others. So I think Washington whistled and the countries came to his heels. And if Finland and Sweden is among them, I don't think it matters very much in the whole formula. The main boss, ruler is the United States. We wanted negotiations with United States on security guarantees in Europe. United States rejected these negotiations, said that it is not a question that they want to discuss. So the West was consolidated. A lot of countries, of course, lost their head, I understand. A lot of countries decided to promote Russophobia and hatred, including United Kingdom, including Poland, including Baltic states. But it's bad for these countries, not for Russia. So what are the effects? The loss of human lives? Yes, it's important, but there were, and every life of loss of life is a tragedy. But you shouldn't forget that there were tens of thousands of casualties daily from shellings of Ukrainian forces in Donbas that you didn't want to see. That was the war that you preferred not to notice. We had to stop this war. If you didn't notice, it didn't mean that it wasn't there.
So you're still saying then, you're to the world, that this has been a success. This operation has gone to plan.
Every military operation is not a success because for me as a diplomat, every shot is of course a bad thing. But sometimes there are solutions which are taken because there is no other solution, because it came to the moment when we exhausted all other means, all diplomatic means. We proposed many times for the West to pressure Ukraine to implement Minsk agreements, which were the only framework for diplomatic solution. The West rejected it. The West was saying that it was Russia that doesn't implement Minsk agreements, though we were not even part of these agreements. So it was hypocrisy. And at some point, people in the east of Ukraine, they just lost conscience and they said that, well, come on, 8 years already, the West doesn't acknowledge that we exist. The West doesn't acknowledge that children are being killed there on a daily basis. So who would save us? It's your hypocrisy that brought all this to this point. We have some 5 minutes, and you promised about denazification.
If you're keen to, let's get into that as our final topic then, Mr. Yeah. Polyansky, because this is something you like to talk about, and I noticed you spoke about it on British TV. This is the second part of the original rationale, which is demilitarization and denazification. Give me the line. Tell our viewers what your argument is, and I will then ask a question.
Thank you. I will just say that for many years, the West was not trying to not to notice that there was Nazism which was cultivated in Ukraine. It was direct Nazism, sometimes indirect Nazism. If you want to learn the facts, and Twitter page of, for example, Edward Dalinsky, who is the head of Jewish Society of Ukraine, who was on a daily basis publishing the information about the honoring of Nazi criminals who were participating in Holocaust and who had blood on their hands, who now become the heroes of Ukraine. You know that Bandera and Shukhevich, who were the leaders of Ukrainian nationalists, are being worshipped by the Ukrainian leaders, including President Zelensky. So the argument that's usually floated is, can President Zelensky be a Nazi when he is a Jew? I would say that if a man speaks like a Nazi, if the man worships Nazi heroes, if the man worships Nazi collaborators, if the man displays on the 8th of March on his official page in Instagram, a picture of a person, you know, this story I told Sky News about this when they stopped, said that we are ever
enough.
The
trouble is,
time.
Mr. Polyansky, I don't think this is the kind of slam dunk that you think it is, because we have run stories on this very fairly, looking at the fact that there are some units within Ukraine that do have neo-Nazi tendencies. That's not especially controversial or, frankly, especially interesting, because there are Nazi components in all sorts of countries, and you can both acknowledge that and totally reject the idea that that is a pretext to invade another country.
It's not a fair parallel. I would say that if, for example, Boris Johnson would say that, I don't know, Goebbels or Hitler is a national hero of the United Kingdom, I think there would be a certain reaction to this. Bandera and
no one's going to invade anyone if he says that. If Sweden starts having neo-Nazi components, which by the way they have had in the past, Norway is not going to invade and say we need to denazify Sweden. The logic doesn't pass muster.
But do you agree that if Boris Johnson declares Adolf Hitler a national hero of UK, at least we could say that there is a Nazi component in Ukraine, in UK. If you say that Hitler is your hero, then there are Nazis in the leadership.
Lots of people acknowledge there are Nazi components within certain battalions and military units in Ukraine, and that doesn't add up to a justification to invade. And that's the thing. You can talk about Nazifying all you like.
But But that was not the main objective.
Okay,
the main objective,
but you're talking about
you,
it a lot.
You've... bringing peace to Donbass.
So you have lots. You seem to have
one
lots
of the
objectives.
Because we think it's blasphemous. We think it's a sacrilege to have Nazi leaders in the neighboring country, to have the population study these people at school and to have them.
So if it's not the main objective, why talk about it so much? So much so that you wanted to bring it back onto the agenda of this interview.
Because I want to speak about it too much, because the British public should know about this, and they should know about the fact that the NATO insignia that people would see on Ukrainian uniform very very often, on the nationalist uniform, also relates to the story when British citizens were killed. And it means that when UK supports President Zelensky and he displays such symbols at the Victory Day and he congratulates the world with the defeat of the Nazis with such symbols, it means that he is laughing at the whole world. And it means that he kind of challenges the British society, saying that there is no problem, guys, that they killed 100 of your countrymen. We still worship these people.
Mr. Polyansky, I know what you're trying to get at there. I'm afraid, I think, if the British people listen to this, and some of them probably will, they will still conclude that what they're seeing, which is vast numbers of military invading and civilians dying and whole cities being shelled to destruction, is almost completely irrelevant from talk of Nazi components. They are not equivalent, and it doesn't excuse it.
The problem is that British people don't know the truth. They really don't see. They have the don't have the true information from what's happening. I mentioned to you the war that Ukraine was waging about Donbass. Nobody knew about this. There was another story, if I have 2 minutes, I would like to refer to it. I see that you're sick and tired of me, but still.
Well, we're running out of time, but you
just
go
a
ahead.
Minute. There was also a story when Reuters was covering the evacuation from Mariupol, and they were interviewing a lady, and this lady, she was very vocal, Natalia Usmanova. She was interviewed by many other people around. So the picture that Reuters showed about this was that this lady was frightened by Russian soldiers, that she had very terrible situation
in the
bunker.
I'm sorry to say, Ms. Polyansky, this is old news. This is old news.
No, it's not old news.
This has been widely covered many weeks ago.
Okay, but...
And it's not... We've been talking about...
For those of your viewers who want to learn the truth, I will show the QR code. This is my Twitter page.
We are talking about... Mr.
And
Polyansky,
please,
you
won't get this news elsewhere because of the censorship that you have in the British press. So if you go there, you will see the difference between the coverage of
you're
the
You're a senior representative of Russia at the United Nations, and we're talking about war and death and tens of thousands of people, and you are wanting to put up QR codes about some story from 5 weeks ago.
It's not five weeks ago.
Baffling.
It's less than a week ago. And this story shows how Reuters censors information about what happened in Mariupol. The way that the British press censors all the information about this conflict, the way it censored the information about the war that happened there for years.
We are part of the British
press. That's why
you're
asking.
And we are sincerely trying to get to the truth.
Displaying absolute ignorance about what was happening there.
Okay.
I'm not blaming you. I'm just saying that people in Britain are absolutely ignorant about what was there.
And the people of Russia, by contrast, you're telling us, are enlightened and have access to all the information.
We have enlightened, absolutely, because we have it not from news, but from those people who were refugees in Donbass for 8 years.
So the Russian media is doing an excellent job of providing all the information to its people.
I sheltered a family of refugees in my own house, so I know about this.
Okay.
My own eyes, and not from news, from your news sources.
Mr. Polyansky, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you. Stay ignorant as you are. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, well, that was Dmitry Polyansky, a senior diplomat from Russia, a member of the Russian delegation at the United Nations, talking to us from New York, and a spokesman from the Russian government. It was at times an exasperating conversation, at times almost eerie feeling. We are, after all, in a time of war, and I've just been having a long conversation with someone that most people in the West, at least, would consider the enemy. Well, you will have noticed you don't see people like him very much in the Western media. You don't see representatives from the Russian government making their case. The reason for this is that the current trend is that to platform people like him is to give airtime to their lies and propaganda, and it's simply doing Vladimir Putin a service. Well, at Unheard, we don't believe in deplatforming as a concept. We think we can get better information, we can get closer to understanding and truth by listening, challenging, and talking, even if the person on the other side is pushing lines from a malevolent regime. I'd rather know what those lines are. It was at times a difficult conversation, but I hope that through all the spin and the talking points, we at least leave with a better sense of how the Russian government is thinking internally. Thanks for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.